This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 16th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Rick Miller, the Montreal actor, playwright, and now TV star, has taken his hit shows McHomer and Bigger Than Jesus across Canada and around the world. Now he's back with a new play, Hard Sell, that takes aim at the ad game. And Breakfast with Scott, the new film about an ex-Toronto Maple Leafs enforcer who also happens to be gay, comes out today. We get a celebrity review when Kelly Rudy joins me. Plus Odessa Havana, they fuse klezmer and Afro-Cuban jazz together for a heady mix. Air Canada, fix that glitch. This is Q. You've heard of a mashup, right? I mean, I know many of you wrote in when we played Rapture Riders, Blondie mashed up with The Doors a couple weeks ago. It's a great song, or songs. Well, we've got a new mashup for you today in Studio Q. Jewish and Cuban jazz. Odessa meets Havana. Matza meets mojito. Quite a concoction. The musical masters in charge of the mashup are, in the Odessa corner, Captain of Klezmer, David Bookbinder. In the Havana corner, King of the Cuban Keys, Lario Duran. Together, they've created a collaboration titled Odessa Havana. It comes out in CD format next Tuesday, and they're touring it across the country. David Bookbinder and his posse are in Studio Q today to be our Friday Live guests, and he's got some of the A-list jazz musicians in the country here with him. Hello, David.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Good to have you here. And you got a nice hat on, too.
I know, because it's radio, so.
That's right. Why not wear a nice... Very quickly, tell me who you've got here. You've got your assembled posse.
We'll go around the corner to my left. We have Quinton Natchoff on reeds and Alex Gaich on violin. I can't quite see him, but over there is Rick Shadrach Lazar on percussion, Max Sennett on drums, Roberto Acapinti, who also produced the record, is on bass, and Luis Guerra on piano.
And it's are people separated into the Odessa and Havana camps?
No.
Not really. You're all mixed together here.
Yeah. Everybody's from Sicily.
Right. Well, okay, so really is a very compelling and sweet new CD to listen to. What are you going to play for us live here to kick off the show?
We're going to play Lila Dance, which opens the recording and just seems to open everything that we do. So this is Lila Dance.
Okay, Lila Dance, Odessa Havana, live in Studio Q. Nice. Live in Studio Q. That's Odessa Havana playing a song from their brand new record that comes out next Tuesday, Lila Dance. That's fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to chatting with you guys. We're going to do that. You're going to stick around for the show, right?
I think so.
All right. Odessa Havana, they are the album comes out Tuesday. They're playing in Halifax this weekend, followed by tour dates in Ottawa, Banff, Vancouver, and Los Angeles.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
He made his name in theater on the fringe circuit with his hit one-man show, McComber. His next hit was Bigger Than Jesus, and though he's not quite at that level himself these days, Canadian Rick Miller can also be found on American TV hosting Just for Laughs on ABC. Rick himself has become something of a one-man brand, an entertainment world commodity, so to speak, which is interesting because last night, Rick Miller opened a new play in Winnipeg, one that tackles our consumption-crazy world, a world where everything is about selling, covered in advertising, showered with persuasive jingles and sexy pitches 24/7. The play is Hard Sell, co-written with his frequent collaborator Daniel Brooks. Writer and performer Rick Miller joins me from our Winnipeg studio now. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Gian.
Good to talk to you. Hey, you know, since your last appearance on Q a few months ago, you've had a hit show at the Edinburgh Fringe, rave reviews for Bigger Than Jesus, and you're a big American TV star.
How about that?
Was it Q that launched all this?
It must have been, Gian.
The buzz was
credit. You can put that on your bio.
Thank you. Launched Rick Miller's. That's the only line on my bio. Launched Rick Miller's career. So there you are with your American TV gig. As we all know, television survives on advertising. Is there a connection between your TV job and doing a play about our sales crazy world?
Well, it's a happy connection, I think, in that I am a Disney employee. I'm officially owned by Disney, quote, in all media, known and unknown, in perpetuity across the universe, unquote. This is in my contract. And
really?
It
says that?
It says that.
You're like Tiger Woods and Nike. You've got it on your forehead. Disney.
Yes, so in a sense, yes, I have sold myself, and part of the thesis of Hard Sell is that everything is for sale. And even though we approach the material with sort of a cynical, I guess, left-wing slant, ultimately, yes, even Rick Miller can be bought. And, we do it because, I've worked hard and I've toured a lot, and this is one way to have a bit of an easier,
I like
easier
that.
Time of it.
The kind of left-wing cynic that sells out to Disney. I see.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a minute from the play, and then you can tell us about the story. Here, okay. Here's a bit of Rick Miller's Hard Sell.
I am a marketing consultant. Originally, I was a child psychologist. And in my work with children, I discovered many things about the brain that were to become very useful in my second career in marketing. For example, the brain is divided into three parts. Now pay attention, folks. You might want to use this around the water cooler. The three parts of the brain are the reptilian, the limbic, and the cortex. Now, we are born already with the reptilian brain. Yeah? It's what is concerned with survival, eating, breathing, going to the bathroom. But then in relationship with the mother, we develop the second part of the brain, the limbic, emotions. In relationship with the mother, we make certain imprints, certain mental connections about words. Yeah? What means mother, what means love, what means home, all these things. These are then übertragen, wie sagen, transmitted by the mother to you. And then we make these mental connections. I call this a code, an unconscious code in the brain. Dr. Clot, this guy. Dr. Clotthard Fugger III. He's my uncle, actually. When I was 7 years old, my mother died, and me and my brother Rick got split up. Rick got sent to St. Clement's School for the Gifted. Me got to live with Dr. Clot and his third wife, Birgit. Good times.
That's a bit of Rick Miller in Hard Sell, the play that opened last night in Winnipeg. Rick, you play two characters there. Who are they?
One is the main narrator of this piece. His name is Arnie. He's Rick's dark side twin brother. Mirror image, really. A bit of a Mephistopheles, sold his soul to the cell, and he's all about the cell and pizzazz and, showbiz. And this other character is who I call Arnie, the uncle. He's someone based on someone we saw in a documentary about sales called The Persuaders. His name is Dr. Clotaire Rapaille, and he is a consultant with 52 of the Fortune 100 companies around the world. Basically, lives in a palace and uses his training in child psychiatry, specifically with autistic children, to sell the world. Hummers and other fun
nice,
things.
Okay.
So this
yeah.
is the kind of world that that I'm trying to explore in a complex way, because it's a very complex issue. And so there are no easy answers to all this because we're so immersed in it. People really literally trying to peer into our brains, manipulate our desires and my children's desires.
Yeah, I mean, you've said that no one has studied us more in the history of humanity than big ad companies trying to sell us things. Is that
yeah,
correct?
The consumer is the most studied creature in history, is sometimes been said.
Well, the press release for this play says, takes audiences through the nightmarish world of selling. What's the nightmarish part?
Well, I think that we are so complicit in it. Again, you know, I play both sides of the coin. I'm partly on the selling side, and what I'm doing right now is speaking to you, and part of that is selling the show. So we're so complicit in it, and we also get Smarties boxes with empty packaging saying that send us your design so that we can then use your design to sell you Smarties. So we are encouraged to be part of the sell, so much so that it's just seen as fun and games. And there is a dark side, a nightmarish side, in that there are literally people, boardrooms of very smart people, trying to get my child to nag more effectively so that we can buy her Dora the Explorer, etc., these kind of things. And I think that's there's a real dark side to all this, and not including all the porn and the sex and the drugs and the crack and all these things that are also part of the sell.
It's a tough line to negotiate, right? I mean, you are playing both sides.
I am, yes.
I mean, literally, because on one hand, you're I guess this is social commentary. The main character, Arnie, repeatedly reminds the audience the play is sponsored by BMO, for example.
Yes.
At the same time, you're giving BMO attention by doing that, right? And you do the same with Disney. You out yourself throughout the play, mm-hmm. and talk about ABC. And reminds me, yesterday we talked about Bono and celebrity diplomacy on the show.
Bono's in the play too, I should add. Salesman Supreme.
Well,
Bono.
The thing is, but also, you know, that's quite controversial in terms of he and the way you two have walked that line. You think back to the Zoo TV tour and you know, playing a rock star and sending it up at the same time he is a rock star. And so all of that grandeur and all of that excess is actually playing out in front of us. How do you walk the line?
It's been 3 years of work trying to figure out how we walk it, and literally how to crack the code. This Dr. Klot guy is literally trying to crack the code of consumers, and Daniel and I were trying to crack the code of what this show is. And part of it was this fine line between pissing the audience off, making them uncomfortable, but also really entertaining them so that they tell their friends about Hard Sell. It is a tricky line, but someone like Bono is a perfect example of someone that I'm fascinated with, because he himself, he lobbies both sides of Congress, and really he's very conscious of this role that he plays. But still, in the meantime, he's written great songs and he's done amazing things, where this guy Arnie, he's sold his soul for performance and for selling, but ultimately all he has to offer is this cynical point of view, whereas all these other people, like Bono and Stephen Lewis, are changing the world one person at a time, really. And he's not. He's just pizzazz. So there's a cost to a life.
I'm listening to the sound of listeners across the country hearing Bono and Stephen Lewis in the same sentence. I'm wondering if they fit together. You know, what I'm curious about is, since you started this a couple of minutes ago, so you're saying that you have been bought out by Disney, you are a Disney man, is there a line? Is there a line that you can't cross? Is there a point where ABC, Disney would come down on you and say, hey, pal, what are you doing? This is, you know, you are biting the hand that feeds you. Or do they like this kind of attention?
It's hard to tell. Sometimes you hear corporations say that it ups their cool factor when they're used within the arts, and if they can laugh at themselves. I think BMO, the art contact at BMO, will hopefully see the show this way. And if they don't, we're going to get a letter that will probably become part of the play. And that's just the nature of this kind of theatrical exploration. We can get away with this because we're not on national TV. We're basically just taking something to a stage. We're playing with issues of ownership and of selling. And if we get a letter from Coke saying that we can't drink a Coke on stage, then again, that becomes content for our play.
That's good to talk to you, Ricky. Tell me, you're from Montreal. You live in Toronto. Why did you choose to open Hard Sell in Winnipeg?
Winnipeg, I've had a great string of shows here in the Fringe days that I just really liked Winnipeg audiences, and I liked the city. And when I had Bigger Than Jesus, when I had the idea for the show, we called Winnipeg, and they basically gave us the theater with 3 weeks of play with all the technicians without a script. And that kind of faith is what we asked again for Hard Sell, and they bought into it, really, because Bigger Than Jesus has become this big international hit. So I think Winnipeg, you know, in a way, it's a focus group, right, using the language of selling, but in a very positive way, in that the audience really does become part of our creative process. And there are very few theaters in Canada that would allow that kind of experimentation.
Rick, it's great talking to you. Congratulations on all the success, and let's hope Disney doesn't shut you down, or that they do if that helps with the show.
Thank you, Jean. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been talking to Rick Miller. His play, Hard Sell, premiered at Winnipeg's MTC Warehouse Theatre last night. It runs until December 1st, moves to Toronto in January, and then it'll be in Vancouver.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameshi. Highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine. And I am not Gian Gameshi.
Odessa, Havana are in the house playing with us all day here, all throughout the show.
All day, all night.
Yeah, all day, all night. As soon as I put this disc on, it made so much sense to hear klezmer type of melodies and sounds over top of Cuban rhythms. And yet it was like a chocolate and peanut butter. Of course they go together, but I'm not sure I've heard it in the past. David, how did this come about?
Well, it's really, I started thinking about this 20 years ago. I was playing some salsa before I ever even heard klezmer music, but I'd grown up with some Jewish sounds, maybe from synagogue, and I already heard that. I heard it in the melodies. I heard it in, you know, the folk approach. I heard it, it just reminded me of it. Once I started playing the Jewish music, playing klezmer, and I was starting to arrange it, it just kept finding its way. Something of the Cuban buzz found its way into what I was doing. But I left it for a long time. And it was only after I played with Eladio Duran in 06 at the Junos, playing completely unrelated music, my own stuff, that I suddenly thought, oh, here's a guy I could do this with. And it started to really make sense to me to really see what would happen. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to, has this fusion ever been done before?
I think there's a guy named Roberto Rodriguez.
Yeah, he was with Mark Rebo's band, Los Cubanos Postizos.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
and
he did that thing.
He grew up, he's a Cuban guy who grew up in Miami around a lot of Jews and heard Jewish music growing up, and then actually put out a recording that's on the same label that this is, which is John Zorn's Tzadik label. So that's how, but it's also predated by this big craze, mambo craze in the 50s, which came out in New York and which had a lot to do with Jewish listeners, Jewish producers, and a guy named Irving Fields,
yeah,
who had a Bagels and Bongos record that sold 2 million copies.
Yeah,
and,
no, it was a big
Bagels
deal.
And Bongos.
Bagels and Bongos.
This is
and then
I love
it.
Dirty Dancing. They were dancing mambos and stuff.
Well,
in
Roberto,
the Catskills.
Yeah. Deconstruct this musically, if you can, in an everyman way, so I understand it. You produced this record.
I'm not Cuban.
You're not Cuban, and you're not Jewish.
No, I'm not Jewish.
So you're the perfect objective. You
Sicilian.
Did produce.
He's perfect. He's right
Sicilian.
In between.
You're
he's
Sicilian. You produced the record. You also
I'm
play
Canadian.
Bass.
This is. I mean, actually, when it all comes down to the fact that maybe people remark upon it, but the fact is, we live in Toronto, where you're mashing up, as you say, all the time. You have, you know, you're going to eat Thai food last night, and maybe you're going to have corned beef on rye tomorrow. Who knows what we're going to have for lunch? So it's a normal thing. I think
it does seem to make sense coming from this country.
And everybody's involved with a lot of different things all the time. So this just happens to be through the prism because of David's background and Eladio's thing. These things maybe got filtered in a little stronger than some of the other
musically,
things.
Musically. Tell me how the two strands actually intersect to make
actually,
sense with
I
each
mean,
other.
From a musicological point of view, a lot of the immigrants that went to Cuba from Spain come from part of Spain called Galicia. And Galicia, back in the day when the expulsion of the Jews, you know, all that stuff there, musically it goes back to that, the scales that they were doing. Well, and they're related to both musics because, you know, when you get that sound of flamenco music and the stuff that goes into Cuba and Argentina, there's that flavor. And it's the modal thing that also went the other direction.
Yeah, what happened was
Odessa.
I mean, it comes from medieval Muslim Spain, right, where there was a huge cultural flowering. The Jews in Jewish history, it's considered a golden age of culture and math and music and science and all these things. And And after the Christian Reconquest and the expulsion, a bunch of the, most of the conquistadors and I think the colonists went from Andalusia, which is the south of Spain, to Cuba. And in the other direction, a lot of them went to other Arab lands, but a lot of them went to Eastern Europe. So there's an actual connection. In terms of musically, you know, minor scales. And a certain way of using minor scales, and a certain, and if you take a thing called a harmonic minor scale, which is used a lot in Cuban music.
I keep looking at you guys because I think you're welcome to play a background for us if you feel like it.
Well, no, we have to explain to him what a minor scale is. Minor scale is what we're getting paid today.
Oh my God! You with the accordion and the jabs and what a, you know, Roberto? What happened?
That's
to you?
Well, not what happened. That's Roberto, man. He went, and
what about
rhythmically
too?
Well, rhythmically, you can say that that first of all, they're both hard driving musics. Cuban music in general is a lot more rhythmically sophisticated and complex. But if on a very simple level, if you take one of the main Jewish dance rhythms, which is a Bulgar 3-3-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, which is also every other dance rhythm,
dance hall
and everything else,
reggaeton.
That's half a clave. You know that. So right there, there's a rhythmic connection. But I think what Roberto was saying has a lot to do with it, which is that we live in Toronto, you know, in this very simple thing where I was going to play at the Junos, CBC wanted me to do something. I said, Roberto, who's around? He said, call Eladio, to play completely unrelated music. So I met him there, and then it's kind of very natural for us to get into this thing.
We're going to hear more music from you in a few minutes. You're taking this across the country, or you're starting this tour in Halifax on the weekend. Obviously, as Roberto says, I mean, in Canada, we're increasingly used to this kind of fusion. It comes second nature. But have you heard from the respective audiences, the klezmer audience or the Cuban audience, the reaction to this disc, and what is it?
Well, I think we will hear it. It's just coming out now. But I know that, for example, in Halifax, they've gotten both communities involved. And they're, I forget
all
what it's called.
All seven of them?
Yeah, exactly. The seven Cubans in Halifax and the 35 Jews.
Roberto, can you just come back as the straight man or the funny man?
That's what he specializes in.
Isn't that the next one you're talking about?
Okay.
But come on, Max, you should be getting some rim shots or something.
Okay, well, listen, it's a pleasure to have you guys here. Odessa, Havana, what I'm going to do is it's going to take you, there's actually a lot of musicians and a lot of instruments set up here in Studio Q. While you go over there, I'm going to move on to talking to Kelly Rudy, but I will say, that's David Bookbinder and Roberto Ocupinti from Odessa, Havana, the musical collaboration. The CD is out on Tuesday, and their national tour kicks off this weekend in Halifax. We got about 5 minutes left, guys, in this. You got something?
We got something.
That can fit in there? What is it?
It's Impressions. Impresiones.
Impresiones. This is Odessa, Havana, the new project fusing klezmer and Afro-Cuban sounds, playing live in Studio Q, All-Star Jazz Players. Take it away. Thank you. playing live in Studio Q, the all-star jazz ensemble that is Odessa Havana, fusing the sounds. The new disc comes out next Tuesday. It's called Odessa Havana.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
Well, if you're a regular listener to Q, you might know that sometimes we have this celebrity reviewer gig. That's when we send a non-critic, a civilian, someone who's got a special connection to the content of a movie or performance, to check it out and report back to Q listeners. Today, it's a new film, Breakfast with Scott, that's already sparked some debate. It's a comedy about an issue that makes some people nervous, homosexuality in sports, and not just any sport, our national game, well, our unofficial national game, hockey. So Q decided to send someone you might recognize from his work as a commentator at Hockey Night in Canada, Kelly Rudy. Before that, you might also know Kelly was an NHL goaltender for 15 years, playing with the New York Islanders, the LA Kings, and the San Jose Sharks. 9 years ago, he traded in his skates for a microphone at CBC Television. Today, we've reached him at his home in Calgary, Alberta. Hello, Kelly.
John, how are you, buddy?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thanks.
So it's you don't have enough going on with the X player, the TV gig. You want to be a movie reviewer now.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? No, you know what? I don't know very much about movies anymore. I don't know if your listeners would agree, but it seems as though the older you get, the harder it is to find time to follow the movie scene. So my kids know all the hot actors and everything, and I know very little about it. Although I have to tell you, Gian, this movie is, I really enjoyed it. Breakfast with Scott.
Okay, well, let's do it. Here, you sit in that movie reviewer chair. Yeah. You are the Siskel. You are the Ebert. Give us a brief rundown of the movie story.
Well, you know, I hope that the makers of the movie would agree with this comparison. I thought it was very much like Kramer versus Kramer with Meryl Streep and Dustin Hoffman. Now, I'm not going to suggest it's done to that caliber. I did like the acting and all that, don't get me wrong, but, I mean, when you're talking about Streep and Hoffman, you're talking about incredible acting performances. But the storyline I found was very similar. Like, what is the best environment for, in this case, Scott? So Scott happens to be a young gay person, and his mom passes away from a drug addiction, and now they have to find the best living environment for Scott. And it's actually, I thought, very well done. One of the dilemmas would be this ex-NHL player, Eric McNally is his name in the movie. And
played by Tom Cavanaugh.
Yeah, and it very well performed, by the way. And he's now a broadcaster like myself, and he lives with his partner. And they bring in Scott, and it's what's best, and I think that Eric is dealing with some of his problems. Does he want people in his industry to know that he's gay and all that kind of stuff? So I thought it was really good, and you can really relate to the dilemmas that everybody's facing, and you know that Scott has to be in a loving environment and develop himself as well. So I really enjoyed it.
One of the things you don't know, did you think that Scott was gay? I thought that's sort of left unclear, but I guess the point is he's sort of he likes singing musicals, he likes dressing up, he's not that, he doesn't know who Gretzky is.
Right.
And so, you know, he's not a macho kid.
Right, and he goes to school and he overdoes his makeup that day and he loves to go shopping and he has all these flamboyant clothes and all that. So maybe I'm jumping the gun. Maybe he's not gay. I just assumed by his sort of flamboyant nature that he was, and I just really thought that it was really good. There's some good, real humorous parts in it. So I recommend people go and watch this.
Interestingly, Tom Cavanaugh, the Eric McNally, as you say, he plays an ex-NHL player turned sports commentator.
And a tough guy, too.
A tough guy, total tough guy. Yeah. I mean, you have a little experience with this career path, though, the NHL player to sportscaster. Interestingly, he seems to, I mean, the subtext of the film is, well, it's really about him and his dilemma in terms of coming out and whether he's comfortable. But he's not just uncomfortable as a hockey player, but also uncomfortable when he becomes a sportscaster. He doesn't want people to know, he doesn't want to come out, which speaks to not just hockey, but the entire sports culture and the culture of acceptance around homosexuality, which, you know, isn't a big deal in films now, but I guess is a big deal when you add in the sports factor. What did you see in that, not just as a hockey player, but as a sportscaster?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things when I look back upon my days in the National Hockey League is as much as they're respectful of all peoples and different lives and so on, you don't really get, it's a very sheltered life in the sense that, you know, you can, you make a fair amount of money, so you can do things that other people maybe can't do, but it's sheltered in the sense that you're basically just around other athletes, male athletes, and you only have those same sort of circles and connections, and you don't branch out very much into different walks of life. And by that, I was surprised, actually, when I left hockey, how little interaction I had ever had with women, because basically there aren't very many women around in our occupation, and diversity training and all those sorts of things. So when I moved from playing in the National Hockey League to the CBC, it was a real eye-opening experience for me, and I had to deal with experiences that I hadn't very much before. And so I can really appreciate how in this movie he goes from playing in the National Hockey League to broadcasting and trying to know himself and get to know himself a little bit better, and what can I do and how far can I go and how accepting are all these people. So I found that really interesting.
You know, I think we would need more time to get into a sophisticated deconstruction of where homosexuality and homophobia are at in hockey and sports. But with specific regards to this film, it's getting some, it's getting some negative buzz around this, what you might call the last taboo in hockey, this taboo territory. A blog, the James Hartline Report, declares the NHL immoral for backing homosexuality by being part of... What is it about a gay man in a hockey uniform, do you think, that makes people so uncomfortable?
Who knows? You'd have to ask that guy. I probably shouldn't laugh, but I can't imagine being that unreasonable and thinking and becoming so angry over something like that that you write a blog about it. To me, I think that I can't necessarily speak for the National Hockey League, but I can tell you that for the most part, everybody, I'm sure, that plays in the game and or administers parts of the game, they would enjoy the movie. And there's nobody that's worried about a homosexual in the game and all that kind of jazz. I hope that...
But at the same time, Kelly, we have not had a prominent openly gay NHL player, have we, right?
We haven't, but I think it's safe to assume that we've had gay people playing hockey.
Right.
We have to assume that. That's pretty natural. So I think we've really moved on. Again, I don't, like I said a few minutes ago, there's no training for it in pro sports, to the best of my knowledge. So I think that it might be a direction that they might need to go, just in case somebody identifies himself in that manner. But listen, I think most hockey players, if you asked them about their thoughts about that, they'd be exactly like me. Hey, I like the movie. I can understand his dilemmas and all the issues that he's going through. And I hope that people don't think that it's like this person is trying to portray on that blog.
Let me just get a quick word from you on the Toronto Maple Leafs involvement in this, because the film really garnered attention when the Leafs allowed their logo to be used, becoming the first major pro sports team to lend its logo to a movie with a homosexual theme. Do you think this is a progressive step for such a prominent sports organization? Do you think it's a big deal?
I do, and I think, as you said, it's such a prominent sports organization that it's a perfect fit. And I think that it's going to go a long way towards dispelling some of these rumors that people may have, and again, referring back to that blog site that there's no place for it and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's a real good connection with the league and with society.
Kelly, it's good to talk to you. I'm thinking maybe you should give up the Hockey Night in Canada gig.
Become
the Q reviewer, film reviewer.
Well, you know what? Let's do it again then. Send me another movie down the road and I can review it.
Anytime, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye. Kelly Rudy, retired NHLer and Hockey Night in Canada star. The film Breakfast with Scott opens in theaters today in Toronto and Vancouver, and I suppose a wider release coming soon.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday after local and regional noon programs, and again at 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Odessa, Havana, you promised you'd play a third song for us. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is the one tune on the recording that's not original, fully original composition, and Alaya and I thought we'd do something like this just to as a kind of object lesson to say, well, if you're really going to put the two traditional sounds together, what would you get?
Dolly Parton tune?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Top heavy and everything. But so I just gave him a whole bunch of really old Yiddish melodies, including something found in an archive in the Ukraine of some guy in a village from 1905. And he took the melodies and arranged them with not just Cuban, but South American dance rhythms. So these are really straight up Jewish dance melodies over Latin American dance rhythms, and it's appropriately called Freilich's Tumbao.
Odessa Vanna live in Studio Q. Thank you. Nice. Yeah, you can clap the seven fingers truth there. Wow, that's Odessa Havana playing live in Studio Q.
This is Q, the podcast. Let us know what you think. Send us an email at q@cbc.ca.
Traces isn't your average circus show, and you know it from the moment the lights dim and the opening announcements begin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Traces. Please leave your cell phone on during the performance. You never know who may be trying to reach you. Feel free to use flash photography, even if it means the artists could be permanently injured. You may use the restrooms at any time during the performance. You will never really know what you missed.
Oh, well, there you go. Then out of the dark, five figures come hurtling onto the stage. For the next 90 minutes, they leap, they tumble, spin, and dance around the stage using a variety of props, skateboards, an armchair, a basketball, two tall poles, a huge metal ring, just to name a few, and an astonishingly fresh playlist of songs from Radiohead to Rycooter and Blackalicious. It's been called Rent meets Cirque du Soleil. I'm not sure what that means. I do know that I saw it and loved the originality. This is like a rock and roll show. It's one that sends a big, finger, or perhaps seven, to gravity, safety nets, and conventional circus performance. Traces was created by Montreal's Les Sept Doigts de la Main, or the Seven Fingers, after sold-out rave performances at the Edinburgh Fringe, Washington, D.C.'s Kennedy Center, and Dublin's Theatre Festival. Traces is just finishing its month-long English Canada debut in Toronto with final performances this weekend, and it'll head to Montreal from here. I have three of the five performers in studio today. Will Underwood, Francisco Cruz, and Eloise Bourgeois. Welcome to the three of you.
Hi, nice to meet you. Okay.
Sorry, I've been calling you Traces, but you're actually Seven Fingers, right?
The company is called Seven Finger, and our show is called Traces.
The show is called Traces. So, but you, the three of you are how many fingers are you?
But the company was created by seven people 5 years ago, and our show was created 2 years ago, and we are like five extra artists, so now there is a total of 12 artists, I would say, in the company.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. I mean, I know that none of you are Canadian. How did you come to be part of this Montreal-based Seven Fingers company, Francisco?
Was it 5 years ago then?
Yeah, about.
It was me, my brother, Will Underwood, and then Brad Henderson, who's not here. One of the creators, actually, of Seven Fingers, Gypsy Snyder, she kind of told us, hey, there's a circus school in Montreal. You should go check it out, because we're all 18. I mean, at least three of us were 18. My brother was only 15 at the time. And she said, go to Montreal, check out the circus school. And, you know, because we were thinking, okay, we're going to go to university now. What are we going to do? So we actually ended up flying out to Montreal for the audition, and we all got in and got accepted. So my brother took his GED early to get out of school early, and we took off and went to Montreal.
So you're a bunch of California kids.
Yeah.
You were one of these guys.
Yeah, from San Francisco.
Yeah,
we've known each other since we were six or seven. So yeah,
we all started in San Francisco.
And what did you, Will, what did you think of going to theater school in a place called Montreal?
I mean, yeah, it was kind of a surprise. We spent all years training and just more for fun, and then as the years went by, you know, we said, oh, maybe this could actually be a job, and the Gypsy, like you said, she's from San Francisco also, and they kind of started their company in Montreal, and they said, well, circus is really happening in Montreal. If you guys want to try to make a profession out of this, come give it a shot. So it was all exciting for me, and I was happy to do something new.
Yeah. And then Eloise, you also went to the school. Is that where you guys met?
Yeah, we met in school.
And so how do you go from there to creating this show? I mean, what's interesting, I was saying to you, Francisco, after your performance, what's interesting watching you guys is there's a lot of anonymity normally in a circus when we see these fantastic performers, but they look like they're part of a big company. You guys look like a band. There's five of you. You're playing off each other throughout the show. It's very clear that your personalities are there. So it's very important, it would seem, that it's you five people. How did you find each other? How did you find them, Eloise?
Well, we were in the same promotion in school, but I started working with William as a duo acrobatic, hand to hand. So we started to know each other, and like in second year, we decided we wanted to like travel a little bit and perform. So we wanted to go in Europe to try to like do something. And we end up going, five of us, for a street performance tour for like 3 months. So I think, I guess that's when we really started like to work together. And after that, we made some video project. And when we finished school, like the company Seven Finger proposed us a contract for these shows.
And you're all, you all seem like multidisciplinary kind of artists. I mean, you a bunch of you play the piano like masters. You're acting throughout the show. You're shaking your head, Will, like Odessa Havana.
Yeah, these guys played, you know. Yeah.
But you're acting through the show. You're also doing these acrobatics and then some kind of fun circusy kind of moves. What do you first and foremost consider yourself, or does it matter, Eloise?
Well, the show that Traces is really multidisciplinary. We try to put all we could do and all different type of way of expressing ourselves, which means like dancing, singing, playing music, doing circus. But I don't know, I think we call each other like circus performer, and it's like everything come into this.
It's also because we knew Gypsy and the other director, Shana Carroll, like we knew them growing up, or they knew us. So I mean, when they made the show, they really wanted to try and capture our, I don't know, personalities, because we don't have like the typical background of circus. We kind of did it more as after school thing. So we really grew up with other hobbies like skateboarding, like basketball. I mean, me and my brother have been playing piano since we were like 7 years old as well, because my mom's a musician. So it's just all things that we kind of grew up with, and they saw that and they wanted to capture more than just our circus tricks. You know, it's not just a technical show, it's a personal show.
It is a personal show, and we find out a lot about you. I want to play a clip from where we actually get to know each of the performers. Check this out.
My name is Eloise. I was born May 5th, 1982. When I was young, I used to fall out of bed. And then I fell in love. And now I'm falling again.
My name is Will. I was born October 25th, 1983. I quit smoking on September 26th, 2006. Woo! Yeah, except sometimes when I drink. And after dinners, in the morning.
My name is Francisco. I was born July 1st, 1983. And I like cereal. I like cornflakes, I like frosted flakes, I like Cheerios, honey nut Cheerios, apple cinnamon Cheerios, multigrain Cheerios. I like Raisin Bran and Raisin Bran Crunch, Rice Krispies, Corn Pops, Cocoa Puffs, Kix, Crispix, Fruit Loops, Honeycombs, Golden Grahams, Shreddies, Life, Alphabets, Oat Squares, Corn Squares, Maple Brown Sugar Squares, Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Oh, I love Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Sometimes, instead of using regular milk, I use chocolate milk.
That's fun watching you three listen to the intro. You're all rolling your eyes and shaking your heads. This is your performance. Will, what's the problem?
I just never heard myself, I guess. It's different when you're doing it.
Why is it so important, do you think, for you guys to out yourself so personally in the show? I mean, it's part of, as an audience member, I felt like I knew you at the end. Is that part of the agenda?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're really lucky. First of all, because to come into that company, and they have this, even though their first show, this being really personal, having this relationship with the audience, so to get a chance to go out there and just kind of, we're not really playing characters, you know, we're just being ourselves and on stage, which is a great opportunity, and it's challenging, but at the same time, you don't get that in most, you don't get that opportunity in most shows.
It's also, so. I think it's refreshing for the audience to kind of like not have that wall between the stage and where you're sitting, and you really get to, okay, these are real people. You know, they have a background, you know, and like as you saw on the show, like we don't make every trick first try, and you know, it's kind of, I don't know, it makes the show human for a lot of people.
Well, what's refreshing about it is that people who are as incredibly athletic and acrobatic as you are, I just assume are freaks, you know, are just, you know, they must be working at this 20 hours a day. They probably have no social abilities. I mean, because what you do, I mean, for example, standing upside down on top of each other and is quite remarkable. And we don't get to know those circus performers. But what kind of a regimen do you have? I mean, how social? It looks like you're just a bunch of kids skateboarding around and then you happen to do this show. But it's hard to believe that this show doesn't come with an incredible amount of rehearsal. Eloise?
Well, when we created the show, we were working like crazy, like 8 hours a day of like physical training, improvisation. Like, I would say that for 2 or 3 months we were really like into the show, but after that, when the show was created, like, we performed more, so we have more contact with the audience, public, and like, for sure, we have a social life, you know. We don't live in boxes and just train. We like do everything.
You don't live in boxes.
No, we don't, for sure. Like, right. We have fun, we do lots of stuff, and we are open to everything, you know.
It's very demanding on you physically. You're all in your, you know, early 20s. Will, do you worry about what this is, the toll it's taking on your body? And most specifically, when we hear news like we just reported about what happened with Cirque du Soleil this week and somebody getting injured, how much do you think about that and worry about those kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, for sure it's a reality. And by the way I see it, you know, we try to take care of ourselves as best we can, and try to be concentrated when we do our shows. For sure, accidents happen, and it's always in the back of our mind. You know, Raphael, one of the other members of our show, he just went in for a knee surgery last week to a little quick operation. And so, yeah, really, that's the first time it actually hit us personally, someone. And but, you know, he's going to be fine, and we get bumps and bruises, but it's worth it.
Do you think about how long you can do this for, Francisco?
I mean, yeah, for sure. It's not really how long you can do it for. It's kind of your choice in technical tricks that you choose to perform. Because once you kind of make that choice, okay, I'm going to put this trick in the show, you have to do that trick every day for the next however long your contract is. So you just kind of get more picky in kind of the moves you're going to do, or start to make that transition into maybe more dance or more acting and less of the circus technique, you know?
Yeah, there's so many aspects now you can... Yeah. Yeah, if you cut down their technique a bit, you can always shine in other areas, you know?
I mean, even in the show we're doing music, so who knows? Like, maybe I'll just go into music instead.
You're a good player on that piano. It's a pleasure to meet the three of you, and it is a remarkable show, and I heartily recommend it. And thanks for coming into to Studio Q here today. I would get you to do tricks, but people can't see it, you know? So they wouldn't believe the things I was saying. Thanks again for coming in. Will Underwood, Francisco Cruz, and Eloise Bourgeois. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Perform in Traces. It's presented by the Seven Fingers. There are three shows left in Toronto. You can check it out at traces.setdoit.com. Montreal, they're coming your way. They're presenting another Traces at Tohu from December 18th to the 31st. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.